You're listening to Air Schooner, listening that moves you. Hosted by Stacy Waite and Scott Winter. The subject is love, and things make it bumpy. To begin with, who would dream of being against love? No one. Love is, as everyone knows, a mysterious and all-controlling force with vast power over our thoughts and life decisions. Love is boss, and a demanding one, too. It demands our loyalty. We, in turn, freely comply, or as freely as the average subject in thrall to an all-powerful master, as freely as indentured servants. It's a new form of mass conscription, meaning it's out of the question to be summoned by love, issued your marketing orders, and then declined to pledge body and being to the cause. There's no way of being against love, precisely because we moderns are constituted as beings yearning to be filled, craving connection, needing to adore and be adored, because love is vital plasma, and everything else in the world just tap water. We prostrate ourselves at love's portals, anxious for entry like social strivers waiting at the rope line outside some exclusive club, hoping to gain admission to its plushy chambers, thereby confirming our essential worth and making us interesting to ourselves. But is there also something a bit worrisome about all this uniformity of opinion? Is this the one subject about which no disagreement will be entertained, about which one truth alone is permissible? Even cynics and anti-romantics, obviously true believers to the hilt, consider that the most powerful organized religions produce the occasional heretic. Every ideology has its apostates. Even sacred cows find their butchers, except for love.
She's Stacy Waite.
And he's Scott Winter. And that was an excerpt from Laura Kipnis' book called Against Love, A Polemic. We're talking about love, love poems, and romance here on Air Schooner today for our episode Strange Love. I'm wondering, Scott, have you ever written any love poems when you were a young kid? Did you ever put any love poems in some girl's locker or anything?
You know, I remember in my undergrad, a creative writing professor, he's from Mississippi with that great drawl, and he just made it clear on the first day that there would be no love poems from sorority girls in this class. And I didn't want to, you know, be one of the sorority girls in class. I ran away from that, and it kind of stuck.
Well, Jennifer Perrine and Sarah Wexler are on the show today, and both writers have a strange approach indeed to love. Let me tell you a little bit about Jennifer Perrine. Her first collection of poems, The Body Is No Machine, won the 2008 Devil's Kitchen Award in Poetry, and her second book, In the Human Zoo, won the 2010 Aga Shahid Ali Prize from the University of Utah Press. She lives in Des Moines, Iowa, where she's Associate Professor of English at Drake University. I got to talk to Perrine about why poets write love poems, and here's what she had to say.
Part of the reason why I started writing poetry in the first place, because I was a hormonal teenager who was wanting to write love poems for other people to impress them. And yeah, that impulse is still there. It's just become maybe a little mutated over time.
Frank O'Hara once said, I write poems because I want everyone to love me. Do you think the poets were still guilty of that?
Some of us. I am. I started being conscious of it at the point where I started realizing that I was writing sonnets constantly and became more aware of the sonnet tradition and how much, how weird the sonnet form even is initially when it began, they were love poems, but they were a little skewed. They're skewed from my perspective now, at least, that, you know, they would pick apart women's bodies and adore each different part and not the whole woman, or they would talk about love in a way that seemed very foreign to my own experience of love. So the way that I write love poems now partially comes out of that recognition that my experience of love is very different from a lot of other people's and that they might find it foreign, and I want to capture a little bit of that for them.
That last thing that Jennifer Perrine said about her experience of love being different from other people's experience, we're about to give you an example of what she means by that. Here's Perrine reading her poem, Portrait of My Lover as Zombie.
You come for me with arms outstretched, low moan sloping from your hopeful mouth, hands that seek the warmth of gut and blushing skin, wishbone plucked from my bird breast. On your tongue, the reek of all the others you've devoured before, their lips still kissing some secret chamber of your slow-blooded remains. There's no war in you, no want but that of the monster, to hunt until there's no more prey, to eat without the need for hunger or the dread of gluttony. I have no hopes to train away this shambling seduction, this sweet disease that whispers for you to embed yourself in me like teeth inside a brain.
So what do you think would have happened if you left that poem in somebody's locker, like in high school?
I mean, who's to say I didn't? I'm sure there were people I creeped out in high school with my love poems. It might not be the most flattering portrait, but there's a certain honesty to that. That there is, at least in certain kinds of love, there is a desire that is so overwhelming that it can seem mindless, and it's easy to succumb to and become, you know, be enticed by the zombie and become one yourself.
You set me up, Stacy. I was expecting something really strange, but that pretty much squares with my whole dating experience from middle school through my undergrad.
Brian has great, she just has great love poems. One's called Battle for My Lover, The Tooth Grinder. She just does really weird stuff with love, so I was glad to have her on the show.
Stacy also talked strange love with another author, Sarah Wexler, who took on a project in which love and romance gets comically strange in her book, Awful First Dates, Hysterical, True, and Heartbreakingly Bad. Wexler has written for the magazines Vanity Fair, New York Magazine, Marie Claire, and Popular Science. She lives in Portland and is also the author of a book called Living Large, From SUVs to Double Ds, Why Going Bigger Isn't Going Better. Stacy caught up with Wexler on her cell phone and got her to read an excerpt from Awful First Dates.
It's funny that I'm now the author of a book about dates, because I'm not sure I'd even been on a date before I turned 25. I usually just met a guy in class or at a party, and if we liked each other, we instantly became a couple. Dates with complete strangers were for romantic comedies or contestants on The Bachelor. But when I moved to New York City in my mid-20s, I couldn't wait to put on some red lipstick and meet a stranger in a candlelit restaurant for a glass of wine. After all, there had to be lots of amazing single men here, 4 million to be exact. One man appeared promising until he announced midway through our chicken tikka masala that he'd just gotten a grain of rice stuck between his throat and his nasal passage, and then proceeded to emit a series of dreadful snorting sounds, I assume to dislodge it, like, but it stuck around probably longer than I did. Another time, I went to a birthday party where I was introduced to a handsome British guy. The friend who introduced us noted that we were both authors and had even been published by the same house, so we must have lots to talk about. When I asked about his book, he said he was a chef who'd written a cookbook. We exchanged numbers and planned to meet up the next afternoon. When I got to the cute French cafe, he was as handsome as you could hope for in direct sunlight. Before we even ordered our drinks, he whipped out a copy of his book as a gift for me. And I guess technically it was a cookbook. Under the illustration of a man clad in an apron and standing over four Jessica Rabbit-like women, I saw the title, Flambé to Get Freaky. Had he been at all nudge-nudge-wink-wink about this, I may have been able to laugh it off, but he seemed deadly serious about his mission to help bachelors manipulate women the world over. He acted as proud as if he'd laid Anna Karenina on the table and claimed it as his own. I tried to keep my eyes from bulging as I quickly scanned the jacket copy and read, "Tired of dates that leave you with nothing but a dinner tab, a doggy bag, and blue balls? I'll show you how to cook an amazing meal that will bring out your date's inner slut, plus recipes that guarantee you access to the back door." Now, I may not be able to remember which feminist wave was second and which was third from my college women's studies minor, but I knew a misogynist when I saw one. I sighed, took a sip of my wine, and tried to move the subject to something I was less uncomfortable with. So I asked, "What's your favorite thing to cook?" He said, "Definitely the tap that ass asparagus soup, or the miso horny cod." I told him I really had to be going, and on my walk home, I left the copy of his book on a bench. It actually surprised me that when I walked my dog later that evening, it was gone. I like to think that he came by and grabbed it, on to regift it to his next potential conquest.
So Scott, that book she's reading from is her gathering stories from all over the world of these horrible bad dates, and I've got to tell you, men aren't looking good.
No, you know, I just love the fact that she can take a horrible event like that and make just a ton of money off of it in that book.
Yeah, it's her bad dates and a lot of other people's bad dates, and she made a list for me of some additional man failures, so here are those.
And just seeing some of the things that guys thought that they could get away with were just totally lacking that appropriateness, you know, asking half an hour into the date if the girl is seeing anybody else because he wants to lock that down. And they've known each other for half an hour.
Wow.
Or guys who, you know, spit out their food into their napkins, guys, like I said, who made, like, racist or sexist comments, guys who invited their moms to the date. But just some crazy, weird, hysterically funny stuff that I felt a lot better researching this book, because I consider myself a fairly normal person, and I've been on a lot of bad dates. And at first I thought it was just being in New York City, and a lot of the dates did come from people who live in New York, but especially once I opened it up to submissions on the website, I got stories from not only all over the country, but all over the world. I got a lot of bad date stories from Australia and from England, especially.
A lot of people say music is the one thing that can bring the world together, but strange love seems to be pretty common in any culture.
Or bad dates bringing the world together. I thought it was really cool just the way this project sort of, you know, from a website turned into a whole book. And I asked Sarah Wexler a little bit about the sort of journalistic process of doing the book. And here's what she had to say about that.
This is a totally different kind of reporting, and it feels, even though it's in print, it feels more in line with an oral history, with that oral storytelling tradition type of thing, because these are the kind of stories that people repeat over and over again at parties, or people are talking about dating or how you met. People love to say, oh, you know, tell us that story about that one guy. I went out once with a Major League Baseball mascot and have had to tell that story at least a dozen times to different groups of friends to request our, you know, their favorite bad date story. So it's a different kind of reporting experience, and it is a lot more about the storytelling than about the sort of factual details. Although we ask, you know, that all the stories be true, there's really no way for me to verify that each one happened.
I know Wexler said there's no way to verify the truth, but we do know, because it was Wexler's date, that guy with the cookbook, Scott, he's a real guy. He's out there in the world.
Yeah, I'm glad I don't have to meet him in the world. I can rather meet him in Wexler's book or on this podcast. Well, we want to thank Wexler, and we want to thank Jennifer Prine for joining us today to talk about love. And I want to thank Rick Galloway for the use of his voice at the top of this episode 14. Thanks for listening there, Schooner.
Air Schooner is a bi-weekly product of Prairie Schooner and produced with research support from James Redd, Ted Wheeler, and Marianne Kunkel. Production assistants are Catherine Larson and Franny Sprowls. Technical support comes from Rick Alloway of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln's College of Journalism and Mass Communications. Air Schooner is produced by Scott Winter and the brainchild of executive producer Kwame Dawes.